Welcome once again to our series, Interpreting the Bible Through the Ages. Our resident scholar, as I like to call him, is our teacher at John Paul II Catholic High of Scripture, Apologetics, and History, Ron Eldred. I'm your host again, Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus here at St. Patrick's Catholic Church, 19th and Poplar, where the Shamrock intersects the street. Ron, welcome once again, and maybe you could review just a little bit of some of the big names we've been covering in our little trip through the ages about interpreting the Bible, because many of these fellows really planted the seeds that blossomed into what Pope Benedict XVI has recently said the major thinking problem of our era, the world era, is what is called a dictatorship of relativism, that we really can't know right or wrong, good or bad. It's just a personal opinion, what I think or what you think, and there is no clear, objective truth, reality, revelation. So could you give us a little review of where we've been?
Well, what we've been doing in the last five or six sessions anyway is taking a look at some philosophers who've had a big impact on the way that biblical scholars think and the way they've performed over two or three centuries anyway, and probably three centuries. There are things other than philosophy, you know, that produced moral relativism, as you just mentioned a while ago. And I believe, if I recall right, in one of our earlier sessions, we looked at four or five different things that contributed to that way of thinking. But certainly, the philosophers that we've been looking at in the 18th and 18th century so far, during the so-called Enlightenment, were major factors. We looked a little bit at Thomas Hobbes. We spent quite a bit of time on René Descartes, a Frenchman who was a believer. In fact, he was a very pious man, a holy man in his own way. But he developed a philosophy to try to explain reality to a skeptical age. Many of the people, the other philosophers and the scientists and people who surrounded him in France and England and Europe at that time, many of them were skeptics, very skeptical about
what you can know,
yes,
what you can't know, or anything for sure, or we're not sure we can know anything for sure.
And certainly that includes, of course, God's revelation as found in the Bible. In fact, especially God's revelation as found in the Bible. So this was leading to a number of men and some women becoming agnostics, even some of them. Certainly a lot of them became what are called deists, a religion that believes that that there is a God, but the God simply, this God simply designed and created the universe, put it into motion, but then stepped back and really didn't have any real interest in it. But that's only one step away from agnosticism, you know, not knowing whether there's a God or not, and then it's only a few steps away to atheism, that there isn't any God. And you can see this as we go through these men that we're talking about right now. As I said, Descartes was a very religious man himself, and really he thought when he developed this system that we described in some detail to save religion. And not only, he was a Catholic, and to save Catholicism, and probably indirectly Protestantism, of course, which was flourishing by this time. The whole idea is that that Descartes, though, if all knowledge comes through the senses, which Thomas Aquinas, of course, had taught, but the senses are so limited, the senses are so flawed, the senses make it militate against us, really, knowing what's outside of ourselves with any high degree of certainty.
I see a tree, but I'm not really sure that tree is out there. because my senses are fallible and I can't trust them.
But not only that, what's in the mind already and has been developed, and then what's outside has to be filtered through the senses, which are flawed, and then it has to be filtered through all of our preconceptions. And so this really brought up and really questioned whether or not we can know anything with any degree of certainty at all. Now, Descartes, I believe that we could, but he believed that the only thing we could know with certainty was those ideas which were placed into our intellect, essentially at birth.
Innate ideas. Ideas we were born with.
Yes, and something for the most part the church had rejected, certainly St. Thomas had.
Back in the 13th century.
Yeah. St. Thomas would have held that that the intellect has certain powers, certain abilities, that it can take this data that's coming in, you know, through our senses, and then analyze it. It can use it. It can draw conclusions and develop principles. And
that's one of the reasons that Pope John Paul II the Great wrote A Fides et Ratio, faith and reason. They are both reliable sources of knowledge. Okay, well, you're on to Descartes. Who came after Descartes?
Well, Benedict Spinoza. We spent probably a couple of sessions on him, if I recall right. And Spinoza was a Portuguese Jew whose family had left Portugal because of the Inquisition there. And this certainly left a rather bitter taste in Spinoza's mouth in regard to the Catholic faith. But he wasn't very favorable to his own Jewish faith. In fact, he was raised in the Jewish faith, went through all the Jewish rituals, the bar mitzvah and everything, you know, when he was 12, 13 years old. But by the time he was 24, he'd become a pantheist, a believer that all is God, that nature is God, that kind of idea.
No personal God.
Yes. But he believed that formal religion, both Catholicism and Protestantism and Judaism, he didn't look favorable on any of them, really. He thought that they all militated against a person realizing the potential of their personality, that they all had a tendency to inhibit the human being, to stifle creativity, to stifle liberty, and all kinds of things of that sort. So,
put a person in a mental and emotional straitjacket.
Yes, and so he developed a whole strategy in his treatise that would trying to teach philosophers, other philosophers and other theologians and intellectuals how to undermine people's faith in the Bible.
Because he really saw that as an enemy, a fountain of superstition that really chained people.
And he did this by questioning everything, by a whole technique of questioning every teaching in the Bible, every statement in the Bible. And if you could do that, if you could get people to question these things, then it sows the seeds, subtly sows the seeds of doubt. And then, of course, his objective was not just simply to destroy Christianity and Judaism, but in its place, upon these ruins, to build his own kind of a liberal utopia, a religion that was boiled down to, stripped of all the miracles and all the prophecies and all the supernatural elements, and leaving nothing but just a kind of a secular, materialistic, liberal heaven on earth or utopia, a religion of love of God and neighbor. But his God was not, of course, a personal God, certainly not the Trinity, not even the Father of the Jews, but just simply nature.
Pantheism.
Mm-hmm.
It's so often these people are striving for a heaven on earth, that we're going to have a new paradise where we're going to rediscover the Garden of Eden if we can get rid of some of these false religious superstitions. Communism said the same thing exactly and destroyed millions of people.
Well, as we pointed out in our series on the Da Vinci Code, when we're talking about Dan Brown, who wrote the Da Vinci Code, I don't know if he ever read Spinoza or not, and whatever, but in a sense, he was questioning, using almost a Spinozan technique, of trying to undermine people's faith. But certainly I think there are some scripture scholars, certainly in the last 200 years, who knew Spinoza, had read Spinoza and his treatise, and who didn't believe in the truth of the Christian faith as taught by either Catholics or Protestant churches, and so did everything they could to try to question what's in the Bible, to undermine people's faith in the Bible.
Okay, who comes after Spinoza?
Well, John Locke, I think, is the one that we're ready to
big
discuss
influence.
Right now. Oh, yes. Most people know John Locke from his political ideas, his two treatises on government. Anyone who's studied American history has come across John Locke and his justification for revolution. Actually, he was justifying the revolution of 1688 in England, but Thomas Jefferson and other Americans picked up on the idea and applied the Lockean principles to justifying the revolution of the Americans against the English. In fact, almost using John Locke's words in the Declaration, some of them word for word.
Okay.
But we're more interested in John Locke here, not in his political ideas as such, but more with his religious ideas.
Okay. So we're actually focusing on John Locke right now. We're up
yes.
to that in our series of kind of going through the history of biblical interpretation. Well, you said that earlier that John Locke, as a philosopher, one who was trying to seek wisdom by thinking clearly, he influenced the development of biblical scholarship. What can you briefly say about that?
Well, he was born in 1632, so that, you know, kind of gives you a reference point, and he died in 1704. So he lived a good part of the 17th century. He went further than Descartes in several ways in explaining how humans know things. He had written an essay entitled An Essay Concerning Human Understanding, in which he described the nature of human understanding, as Descartes, of course, had done in his some of his various works, his memoirs and his Discourse on Method, I think the name of it was. Locke maintained that there are two sources of our ideas, sensation and reflection. And he started out by saying that understanding begins with sense sensations or impressions when they strike the mind being like a blank page or a tablet. And we mean, of course, by sensations, or the senses, our ability to see and to hear and to taste and to our five senses.
Things that come through the
yes.
sense knowledge.
For a blank tablet, he used what became the famous Latin expression tabula rasa, or white sheet or blank tablet or something of that sort.
Well, didn't Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century use the same word?
He did.
Okay.
I was quite surprised when I came across it, because in reading St. Thomas, when he used the word tabula rasa.
Okay.
Because Thomas, you know, taught that all of knowledge comes from the outside.
Okay.
Maybe God does, in special occasions, does infuse knowledge into a person's soul. But that's, that's not the normal course.
Sure.
The normal course of affairs is that all of this knowledge comes from outside.
Through our what we see and what we hear and what we taste and what we touch.
But on the other hand, that's where the raw data comes from.
Okay.
But of course, the human mind, the intellect, which is a part of the soul, one of the faculties of the soul, such as the will and the memory, the imagination, and what have you, the intellect has the ability to develop first principles from this raw data and then form all kinds of deductions from that and develop all kinds of ideas.
Okay, such as, if I see a tree and I feel a tree, I even sense a tree or get the odor of a tree, then I can, it comes through my senses, but then I can say trees universally have this, these components, or this is what makes a tree.
Human beings have the ability, and what you're talking about is the philosophy of realism, where human beings have the ability to strip all of the sensual content from something and get to an abstract idea of tree. and not just a poplar tree or a sycamore tree or this or that or the other kind of tree, but the idea of tree or treeness or treehood or however you want to put it.
Sure.
That animals, of course, don't have that ability to do that, but human beings do have that. That's called, as you use the word, the universal ideas. And the Catholic Church has always taught that universal ideas are real. They're not just some figment of the imagination only.
What makes a man a man? What makes a woman a woman?
Yeah, manhood. That the idea of womanhood. It's something that all of us have in common. Something, whatever it is that makes us,
sure,
a man. Well, once in the mind, according to Locke, the impressions are combined form ideas by reflection. And that's not a whole lot different than what St. Thomas had said in some ways. He said that the mind possesses, quote, no ideas other than those arising from sense impressions or combinations of the ideas formed by sense impressions, end of quote. And because of its emphasis on the acquisition of knowledge with the senses, Locke's method has been called empiricism. And Father John Hardin, whom we've quoted in all of our series on several occasions, up until his death in the year 2000, one of the most prominent catechists and theologians in the world, I think, a Jesuit scholar, in his Modern Catholic Dictionary defines empiricism as, quote, the system of thought that claims that experience is the only valid source of knowledge. You see, this is the problem with Locke, let's say compared with St. Thomas, is that Locke limits our ability to know things exclusively that which is outside of our mind. In contrast to Locke's empiricism is René Descartes' rationalism, which we spent a couple of sessions on, which is a theory of knowledge that the senses are unreliable, so that all knowledge must start inside the mind. Locke is saying all knowledge has to start outside of the mind. That's why it's called empiricism. Descartes is saying the very opposite. He's saying that because the senses are unreliable, for various reasons, that all knowledge must start inside of the mind. That's why we talked about the innate ideas in reference to Descartes. From knowledge, that, in other words, that's innate, or that derives from self-evident propositions, especially mathematical propositions.
Self-evident proposition is 2 and 2 = 4,
yes,
always, all the time.
Or a line is the shortest distance between two points. Anybody who's had geometry, of course, would know that they have what are called the axioms, things that are just simply self-evident. And so you start with in your reasoning process from these things these first principles. And of course, St. Thomas was not totally different than Descartes in that regard.
So, but St. Thomas would say we got knowledge through our senses, and we get knowledge also from innate ideas or self-evident principles.
Self-evident principles,
okay.
Yes. To some extent, Locke was in basic agreement with Descartes, but he rejected Descartes' notion of innate ideas, or that anything is knowable without reference to experience. And he rejected his rationalism. Even though he was an empiricist, Locke did allow that some knowledge could be derived through intuition and reasoning alone, such as knowledge of God's existence and things of that sort. So Locke in the real world was not a total empiricist. Well, okay. Recall from our discussion of René Descartes, rationalism is a, quote, system of thought or attitude of mind that holds that human reason alone can give certitude without experience or verification of facts. He argued that reason alone determined knowledge, and that this could be done independently of the senses.
And that's we're talking about
Descartes.
Descartes and his famous saying, I know, I think, therefore I am. Cogito ergo sum. That's the only way I can really know that I exist, because I'm conscious that I exist.
Two of the most famous Latin expressions comes from these two men. Descartes, of course, in his Cogito ergo sum, and of course Locke in his Tabula Rasa.
Tabula Rasa. Okay.
Again, most people believe that Locke was the one who who coined that expression or invented that expression, but as you pointed out, and I found out in my own reading, Thomas Aquinas actually was the first one to come up with the idea of the tabula rasa, or the blank sheet or the white tablet. The mind's like a blank sheet on which is written by the senses, that which comes through the senses and then written on this mind, this blank tablet or this white sheet.
I think this discussion, Ron, is a good example that heresy or false teaching is usually not what is asserted, but what is denied. In other words, we do get information through the senses, but I deny I can get it from self-evident principles, or I say I can only get it from self-evident principles, and I deny. So I always like that. It's heresy is a what it asserts is usually true, but what it denies is where it gets into trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, he combined Descartes combined rationalism with the idea that humans possess innate ideas, including knowledge of the existence of God, as well as certain basic mathematical axioms and self-evident truths from which to deduct additional knowledge. And since Descartes, many philosophers dismissed innate ideas and instead maintained that reason in itself is sufficient and does not need the help of divine revelation or infused knowledge to know all that is necessary for a person's well-being. In other words, what we're saying here is, and as we emphasized, we talked about Descartes, philosophers who followed Descartes stripped his ideas of its religious content. The idea that we can know God, instinctively, innately, through self-evident
principles. We say from conscience we can.
Yes.
And are from even just reasoning. Okay.
But of course, the problem is this kind of thinking opens the door to skepticism and to agnosticism, and even to atheism in a kind of a downward stair-step kind of fashion with respect to God's existence and his revelation. And if we can't know, in other words, for certain what exists outside of our minds, such as Descartes taught, how can we know what the Bible tells us about God is true? And this is what is meant when we said that Descartes got the ball rolling in the direction of the bad aspects of modern biblical scholarship.
Okay, let's take the next step then. How did Locke's empiricism, or we can only know things through our senses, affect the interpretation of the Bible? And apparently he had some real influence.
Well, David Dungan, whom I've quoted several times, says that considering one's mind to be a blank tablet made it easy for Locke to believe that he was unbiased when considering any matter, including interpreting the Bible. He says that, quote, all one had to do was to let the words in the Bible impress the mind in a direct, simple way without mixing in extraneous thoughts, end of quote. Locke's ideas on the Bible are to be found in his Reasonableness of Christianity as delivered in the Scriptures, which he published in 1695. According to one scholar, the Reasonableness of Christianity originated in Locke's dissatisfaction with many of the theological systems then competing for loyalty in an age of revolution. He is also known as a great political philosopher, as I mentioned at the beginning of our discussion, providing much of the justification for the American Revolution and a certain French Revolution called the so-called Glorious Revolution. He desired to find, quote, a foundation for consensus in religion that would be based upon agreement in essentials and toleration in matters of secondary importance that were merely expressions of human preference, end of quote. Like Descartes, Locke was a religious man who attempted to make Christianity reasonable to believe in an age of skepticism. Unfortunately, both of them, Descartes and Locke, invented systems that other men would strip of their religious content and replace them with agnostic or atheistic systems.
Okay, that's a sad thing, but it often happens that what I intend for good actually plants the seeds of destruction of truth itself. Well, didn't John Locke believe that his system of biblical interpretation was unbiased and not affected by any preconceptions or any ideas of his own?
Yes, he did. He assumed that his approach to interpreting the Bible was objective and unbiased. Moreover, he assumed that most theological systems based on the Bible reflected the biases of those who formulated them. However, his claim that his reading the Bible was unbiased is very questionable. The idea that unaided reason, human reason, has the capacity to discern what is true for all people at all times and all places, I think is a presupposition itself. How does he know for certain that this is true? Of this subject, one scholar has written, quote, Locke does not consider the possibility that his interpretation of the New Testament is no less subjective than the thinkers that he critiques in the pages of the Reasonableness of Christianity. Locke acknowledges that the context in which he lived, a century of revolutionary change in England marked by conflict in politics and religion, prompted him to search the Bible to discern the essence of Christianity as a basis for religious consensus. A desire for agreement predisposes Locke to settle for a minimal statement of content, the lowest common denominator, to appeal to a broad theological spectrum that stretched from deist to Calvinist. He avoids controversial issues of theological discourse, such as the deity of Christ and the Trinity, where such scope for disagreement existed. Locke did not approach the Bible with an unbiased gaze, end of quote. And I think that's one of the biggest problems with Locke and most modern biblical scholars today, is that they think that they are being completely unbiased and objective, while in fact they are not free of presuppositions that they readily impose on their interpretation of the Bible.
Okay, so I carry with me my education, background, ideas, and it's bound to affect the way I interpret things. Quickly, give us some of Locke's ideas regarding biblical interpretation, because our time is running out.
Well, if we had more time, I could give some examples, but let me close with this in regard to Locke. He was a Christian who believed in the literal truth of the Bible, although the conclusions he drew from his analysis of the Bible are in accordance with Christian doctrine. His theology tend to be liberal, on the liberal side, and is intimately connected with the deism of the day. And as we've said on several occasions, deism is a religious philosophy that maintains that God designed and put the universe in motion, but then stepped aside to allow it to operate without any control or interference. One scholar has said that his, quote, version of Christianity commended to the reasonableness of Christianity differed markedly from the emphasis found especially in many dissenting congregations. Locke's Christianity was devoid of enthusiasm, minimized direct contact with God, and did not resonate with the more democratic or participatory instincts of dissenting Christians. And by dissenters, he is referring to the Puritans of his day in England, both Presbyterian and Congregationalist. Like Descartes, however, he had inadvertently developed a system with which others could reach agnostic or atheistic conclusions.
Our time is up, Ron. May God bless you always and in all ways.